I got my costume on.
You came as a judge.
Yeah.
Happy Halloween to all of you, too.
Happy Halloween.
You're supposed to scare us.
He's going to in a minute, Mr. Sales.
No, it's actually my mother's birthday. She wished me good luck. So I thank you for granting my request for oral argument. I'm here this morning because I really believe my client is a victim of gross injustice. I've raised two issues for your consideration. The first deals with consent. The second deals with apparent authority, exigent circumstances. I know you've read the briefs, so I will not go over the facts again. Going to the first issue is whether the district court judge erred in denying a motion to suppress based on lack of consent. And I argued in my brief.
Is that the consent to go into the room or the consent to go into the house?
I would say both.
Well, start with the go into the house. What was the matter with the consent there?
Well, first of all, okay, Mr. Rawls, he's an elderly gentleman. He,
no kidding. How old?
Uh-oh, be careful.
He was 86 or 87.
All right.
Our bridegroom.
Okay.
Well, he's obviously a competent. Anybody that age shouldn't be walking around loose.
No, I'm sure he's a very nice man from everything I read.
Well, I'm just curious.
And I hate to cast aspersions on somebody and say that they had no semblance of reality or what was going on, but that's my firm conviction. I wouldn't be here raising this issue if it was a matter of credibility.
May, where's your age, sir?
Yes, I'll be 55 next month.
Hang in there, you got a couple of years left.
Thank you. And
I'm 71, I'm the baby up here.
Oh, yeah.
I beg your pardon, are you telling these people?
Just show your ID.
What kind of a gentleman are you?
Here, good.
And I a new bride.
Yeah.
I'm so glad the bridegroom is in here.
And I have a 15-year-old.
Let me move forward a little bit. The door to your client's room, while it had a lock, it wasn't locked. It was hanging down. The door was open, wasn't it?
There's some dispute about that, but yes, I believe the door was halfway open. There was a padlock on the outside of the door. It was not locked at that time.
Yeah.
That's right.
And when they walked down through, your client and some other people were in the back room in open possession of narcotics and guns.
There were narcotics in the room. In the kitchen. There was crack cocaine there, and things were chopping it up.
So
and
someplace,
that kind
if you
of
can't
thing.
Keep them out of the house, you're going to have a hell of a time keeping the evidence out other than that.
I know that, Judge. I know it's. I know I'm fighting an uphill battle. I mean, I'm not challenging anything that happened at the trial because there were no errors. I'm not challenging the sentencing because there were no errors there. But in reading the transcript, and I've attached Mr. Rawls' complete testimony in my short appendix, I just believe that he could answer a yes or no question, but anything beyond that, he was completely confused as to what was happening. I mean, the police officers came to him and they said, does anybody else live here? He said, yes, my nephews. They said, what's their last names? He said, I don't know. Another thing that I found striking yesterday as I was reviewing the briefs, and the government's brief, which is excellent, page 16, they say, well, Mr. Rawls was unaware of any kind of illegal drug activity taking place in his house. Well, somebody was smoking marijuana in the kitchen about 20 feet from where he was. And that just struck me as that if he didn't know somebody was doing something
so
illegal.
He didn't pay any attention.
Well, that's possible from what he was drinking. He was just an old man who was ill, who spent most of the day sitting in his bed drinking. Now, does that mean he lacked the ability to consent? Not necessarily. Because even in the Grapp case, you have a person who is severely mentally ill, not taking their medicine. But they found her competent because when the police came to her, she said, you're looking for guns. So even though she was severely mentally ill, she still understood why they were there. With Mr. Rawls, I don't think he understood why they were there, what they were doing there at any time. And that would go to the first issue of the lack of consent. And I realize what an uphill battle that is. But in reviewing what he said before the trial court, you know, most of it makes no sense. And I laid that out in my brief. And I did make one mistake, which the government pointed out. And I wanted to notice that Mr. Rawls' sister did come to his house later in the afternoon there. It was just a lot of paper for me to read. That was a mistake I made, so I want to admit to that. But if you look at the rest of it, I think that any objective person who would review that 9 pages of testimony would say Mr. Rawls just does not understand what's happening to him on a minute-to-minute basis. He can answer a yes or no question, but beyond that, I don't think so. So that's the consent. That was the first motion to suppress. And then going to the second motion to suppress dealt with apparent authority and exigent circumstances. The trial court wanted to find that there was no apparent authority and discussed the issue, but did not. Instead, she went to the apparent authority issue. Now, I said in my brief that the padlock on the door inside of the house was enough to give rise to the police to say, give them question that there was an atypical living arrangement going on in that house. And all they would have had to do is ask Mr. Rawls, what is this? They already knew that two other people were living in the house with him, but they didn't do that. So that's as to the apparent authority, that's all I have on that, but I think that's enough. I mean, I've never been in a house that anybody had a padlock on the inside of a door inside of their own house.
They have got small children quite frequently.
Well, I haven't been in many drug houses either, so but not saying my client's house was a drug house. I'm just saying it's possible. But I believe that that just alone, they could have asked him. All they had to do was ask him. They did not do that.
Door was open.
Yes, but there was a padlock on it, and even though it was unlocked, I believe that that gives rise to the question, was there an atypical living arrangement going on here, which then places a duty on them to ask Mr. Rawls about that. Because he did not have any access to that room. Everybody testified that he did not have a key to that room. So as for the door being open and anybody could wander by and walk in there, I don't think so, because my client was in the kitchen just a few feet down the hallway from it. So, I mean, had somebody tried to walk in there, I'm sure he would have said, get out of there. Okay.
When you say there's a padlock on it, I assume it's one of these things that's got something that's bolted to the wall, and it's got a hinge, and then it's looped, and you put the padlock through it, something like that? Or do you know?
That's what I understand from the testimony. I believe that's what it was.
Whatever it is, it's hanging there somewhere.
Right.
And I assume maybe the padlock's hanging on it? Or?
I believe that it was.
But the door is open, and you can look in and see.
Yes. So, going to the question of the exigent circumstances, I don't believe there were any exigent circumstances. I think the testimony and the record show that when the police were there and they had subdued Mr. Richards, that they had called for backup and there were four or five officers who were milling around the front room of the house and they weren't doing anything. Mr. Rawls and two people who were with him in the front room had, they said, had been patted down but not handcuffed. They didn't have any problem with them. So basically, at the time that there supposedly were exigent circumstances, you have four or five police officers standing around in the front room not doing anything. I don't believe that qualifies as exigent circumstances.
Well, was Richardson sitting down all the time when these others were in there? When did he get up and lose the gun?
The police came in, talked to Mr. Rawls, went down the hallway, smelled marijuana, went into the kitchen. My client and another man were sitting in there. They went over to my client. I'm not exactly sure what happened next, but he got into a scuffle with one of the police officers. They put him down on the ground, and a knife was in his back.
Was after that they went in the room?
Excuse me?
Was after that they went into his room?
Yes. Yes. So
that was my understanding of the record.
Yeah. There was a knife in his back pocket, which he admitted to. He never reached for it. A gun was found on the floor. They say it fell out of his pants. He says that the gun was not his. He never tried to reach for that either. So I see I'm into my rebuttal time. So do you have any questions on what I've just discussed?
No. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Kapp, good morning.
Morning, Your Honors. It pleases the court, David Kapp. I'm the United States Attorney, Northern Indiana, for the government. Counsel referenced the Grapp case. In Grapp, the mother responded that the police officer, are you here about guns? We have an analogous situation here. Police officers identified themselves to Mr. Rawls and told him why they were there, and that was to execute an arrest warrant on Paul Wilson. Mr. Rawls immediately responded, said, he's not here, but go ahead and look around. This gentleman knew what was going on that day and was able to have the capacity.
Hard to believe. at that advanced age that he knew what was going on any place.
But I'm sorry, Judge.
I said hard to believe at that advanced stage he knew what was going on.
I think he knew exactly what was going on. In fact, probably the person who testified who knows this gentleman the best was his sister, Catherine. Catherine had a power of attorney for Mr. Rawls' financial affairs, but Catherine stated in her testimony that her brother would definitely understand what the police were asking and what the police were doing.
How old was she?
You know, I don't know, Your Honor, and I don't believe that was in the record. There was two evidentiary hearings below. Senior District Judge Lee heard Mr. Rawls, heard his sister, and heard the three principal police officers. Judge Lee found the police officers credible. The second evidentiary hearing was before Judge Springman. Judge Springman did not hear Mr. Rawls. She heard the sister, a few other witnesses, and again, those same three police officers. Judge Springman found those police officers credible. These officers came to the door, knocked, identified themselves, stated their purpose, immediately ascertained that Mr. Rawls was the owner, spoke with Mr. Rawls about their purpose. As I said, Mr. Rawls said, he's not here. Go ahead and look around. The door's wide open. They notice the odor of marijuana, see bodies in the kitchen, go into the kitchen, crack cocaine, marijuana blunts, other paraphernalia, a scuffle with an individual that turns out to be Mr. Richards. They have to physically subdue him, gun in his waistband, knife in his back pocket. Now you've got a very dangerous situation. You've got a drug house with weapons. At that point in time, those police officers were well within their rights and clearly justified to do a brief protective sweep, which is what they did. Part of that protective sweep involved looking into the bedroom in question, and there in plain view is an open briefcase with a bag of crack cocaine sticking out of it. At that point, other officers arrive to assist. They go back to Mr. Rawls and talk with Mr. Rawls to get some more information about who's supposed to be there and things like that. Mr. Rawls gives them that information that I let my nephew stay here once in a while. They help me out a little bit, but they don't pay rent, things like that. They review a consent to search with Mr. Rawls. They read it to him, and he signs the consent to search. And as I said, his sister, who arrives later, testifies, my brother certainly would have understood what the police were doing that day. There was no hint of coercion, which is generally the issue in almost all of the voluntariness cases. There wasn't a hint of coercion. The police were polite and respectful throughout. In Mr. Rawls' own words, the police were nice to him.
One thing I didn't notice, were the police uniformed? Or?
Yes, they were uniformed, Your Honor. In fact, I can't say for sure they both were. I know the one was because I believe in his second testimony he indicates I was dressed as I am now, to wit, in a police uniform. So I know at least one of them were, and I believe both of them were. So there wasn't a hint of coercion, and as I said, Mr. Rawls testified they were nice to him. And again, back to his sister, the person who probably knows him the best. The sister says when she got there, her brother was talking and, quote, laughing with the police. So this was not a situation where there was any coercion. There was no repetitive request of Mr. Rawls. It was professional throughout. Mr. Rawls knew what he was doing. Judge Lee found that. Judge Lee found the officers credible. Judge Springman likewise found the officers credible. And the government would urge this court to affirm the findings of the district court on all three grounds: the exigent circumstances, the ability to consent, and the apparent authority to consent. If there's any questions? Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Bath. Okay, Mr. Sales, how much time? 1 minute. Well,
that's plenty of time for me. I believe that all the police officers that day were wearing uniforms. As for Catherine Rawls, in fact, she had already obtained a power of attorney for Mr. Rawls' legal and financial matters. People don't obtain power of attorneys for other people if those other people are that competent. But she also testified that sometimes he knew what was going on, other times he did not. So now, as for knowing him best, maybe she did, but she didn't actually live there at the house with him.
It describes people of almost any age, but go ahead.
Well, a person could be 110 and be competent, and a person could be 20
32
and be incompetent.
32 and not know beans from bananas.
That's right.
By the way,
that's
let me say in passing, I thought you drew an excellent brief. It's a good brief, and I congratulate you on it.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here. This is my first time on a criminal appeal.
Is it?
Yes. So the government's brief was excellent, too. I mean, I've enjoyed the whole experience.
Good.
So it's just
enjoyed having you.
Thank you.
We want to thank you for taking on this appeal and really for representing your client so well. And we always thank the government, of course. Yeah, well argued and well briefed to both of you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, and I want to thank you all for taking us before lunch, too, and not having us come back at 1:30 or something like that. Thank you very much.
Don't eat too much candy, you two. All right. Believe it or not, folks, we're going into the last case of the day. And that case